corral around the kettle, you henpecked Declans. Welcome to the Blind Buy Podcast. Got some new listeners this week because I made an appearance on the Adam Buxton podcast. Adam is someone who I've admired for most of my life because I grew up watching him on TV in the Adam and Joe show, and I had the privilege this week of being a guest on the Adam Buxton podcast. So check it out if you haven't heard it. We spoke about how art movements like Situationism and Dada can have influence on comedy. It was very enjoyable. If you're a new listener to the podcast because you heard me on Adam Buxton's podcast, welcome. You delicious cunts, welcome. What I always say to new listeners is go back and listen to some earlier podcasts rather than going deep into this one. Start off with some earlier Blind Buy podcasts and familiarise yourself with the lore of this universe rather than going conkers deep into this, you know. For regular listeners, what's the crack? How are you getting on? I hope you've been having a charming lockdown and quarantine, that you're not being too hard on yourself, that you're embracing the current chaos of the universe, that you're embracing that which you can't control and focusing on what you can control. What I do have for you this week is some escapism, okay? I've got some real podcast hug escapism for you to listen to this podcast this week and switch off from whatever the fuck is bothering you and lose yourself in the universe of the podcast hug, alright? First, I'd like to read you a little excerpt of something. When I was a young fella of about 6 or 7, the neighbours had a Yank cousin called Jake over to visit. He was sound enough and he had ties of the Turtles, which I'd never seen in Ireland. One day, I says to him, "Are you going to the shop? You are." And Jake gets this pure bowsy look across his lip, like I was trying to pull the piss. "Why are you telling me to go to the shop? I'll go to the shop if I want to," he says. "I was only asking. I wasn't telling you to go to the shop, Jake," I said. I'd no idea what had gotten him upset. Now my dad was over by the gate listening in with a smirk. Later on he says to me, "That thing earlier with the young Yank, when he thought that you told him to go to the shop, do you know why he couldn't understand you?" And my dad then explained to me a theory about the way Irish people speak English, a theory which was given to him by his dad. My granddad lived on a boreen below in West Cork that was on the way to a creamery. He was a member of Tom Barry's IRA flying column and would constantly watch and take note of whoever passed. Regular Irish people would traverse with their horses loaded with buckets of fresh milk and would come back with horses packed with butter in their saddlebags. And this was a brisk, fast-paced road, no time to stop and chat, because milk would go sour in the sun and butter would soften on a horse's shoulders. It was for this reason that British soldiers would stop and harass anyone who walked the boreen to interrogate, to rile, to get horses pure greasy with sweaty yellow butter. A small injustice, a show of power, and an opportunity to make a person emotional enough to lash out and say the wrong thing. My granddad would notice that when an English soldier questioned the man on the way to the creamery, no answer would be right or wrong. Any answer meant a long wait and your papers inspected regardless. The standard rules of human interaction had broken down, and to give an answer as Gaelga would be met with violence. So the Irish people figured out an in-between, a yes and a no at the same time, a quantum superposition of an answer that would cause the soldier to say stupid paddy gibberish and usher the person off before the butter melted down the horse's shoulders. And this here was my dad's theory as to why I asked the American, "Are you going to the shop? You are." It was an absurd post-colonial way of arranging a question that had its roots in years of interrogation from the English. Now, I'm not saying that's the case. This is just a story that was passed down to me. But as an adult, I learned that there was a name for how I speak, how I arrange sentences and for the words that I use. Hiberno English, a resistant way of speaking the English language, a language we never asked for. As an author and a musician, I often find myself writing words as if they're music. I search for melody and rhythm on the page. Jazz and blues are African-American forms of music, born out of the resistance of African songs to European instruments. Musical notes exist in the African scale that don't exist in the Western scale. These notes are in between the Western notes, and these in-between notes give jazz and blues an emotional complexity that the traditional Western scale cannot deliver. The playful, bold, and fluid way that Hiberno English resists traditional English does the same thing. This improvised musicality to how we think and speak provides me with a deep literary confidence to explore the in-between, especially when the writing process presents me with resistance. So what that was there was, that's a foreword that I wrote for a book called A Dictionary of Hiberno English. And Hiberno English is the English that we as Irish people speak. We speak our own version of Irish. And that little story there, that's what my dad used to say to me. My dad used to say, we speak Irish in a confusing way because of 800 years of interrogation. And it's just my dad's version of it, based on what his dad told him. It's a folklore tale, I suppose. But the Dictionary of Hiberno English, it's Gill Books, who are the book company that published my first two collections of short stories. This Dictionary of Hiberno English was made by Dr. Terence Patrick Dolan. And he was a professor of English. And he compiled this massive dictionary of Hiberno English words. Words that are English but uniquely Irish. And it was out of print, right? I ended up seeing it online about a year ago, 2 years ago. And going, fuck me, I want a copy of this book. And I couldn't find it online. And I went to Gill Books and I said, do you even have a copy of it? Because ye published it years ago. And they're like, we don't even have a copy of it. So I said to him, you need to fucking republish this book. This dictionary of Hiberno English words that has... You need to re-release it. You need to get this fucking book because it's a shame for it to be out of print. Re-release the fucking book. And I'll write the foreword for it. And I'll tell everyone on my podcast about this wonderful dictionary. The only one in existence that has got thousands and thousands of Hiberno English words. Words like queer, or which I explained a few weeks back, are words that I grew up using, like gowl, calling someone a gowl, or a gowl. Sometimes the word gowl was a name for a fanny. And gowl, like, you're like, what the fuck does gowl mean? G-O-W-L. And we just thought it was a Limerick word. It comes from the Irish word gaval, to mean junction. Or other words I would have grown up saying, I'd call the guards a shade, or a woman was called a bior. And these words then, they come from Shelta, which is the language of indigenous Irish travellers. So this book, The Dictionary of Hiberno English, it's not my book, but it has my name on the front of it because I wrote the foreword. But the book is by Terence Patrick Dolan. It's in shops at the moment. Go out and check it out. Also, I don't profit from sales of the book. I took a small fee for doing the foreword to it, but mainly this is me just doing the right thing, putting my name to the book so that it gets reprinted and it doesn't get lost, because that would be a fucking shame, you know? Because, I don't know, it just broke my heart to think that a resource like that is out of print. Do you know? You don't want to lose... Like, Hiberno, it's the way that we speak English. It's our way of speaking English. It's a post-colonial way of speaking English, you know? It's the rose that grows from concrete. The Irish language was taken away from us by the British, and we were forced to speak English. And it's like, you can force us all you want, but we're going to find our own way to speak English that's Irish. And that's what Hiberno English is. And finding out what words mean, you know, what does a word mean, and why does it mean that? Why does it mean the thing it means? Is called etymology, right? And my guest this week has just released a book, which is about the etymology as such of the Irish language of Gaeilge. And my guest is called Mancán Magan, and Mancán wrote a book, 32 Words for Field. And what it is like, it's a meditation on the Irish language. It's a meditation on certain Irish words. I mean, it comes from the Irish language, has got 32 words for field. And Mancán's book is an etymological meditation on this. The book says, the richness of a language closely tied to the natural landscape offered our ancestors a more magical way of seeing the world. Before we cast old words aside, let us consider the sublime beauty and profound oddness of the ancient tongue that has been spoken on this island for almost 3,000 years. So, I had the opportunity to speak with Mancán, and I recorded it. I'm getting really good at recording long distance chats and making them sound like we're sitting in a kitchen together and achieving that podcast hug. I'm really looking forward to showing you this fucking interview, because Mancán isn't just someone who's interested in the etymology of the Irish language. He's also a travel writer. He's someone who has been all around the world and is a very thoughtful, compassionate person and an incredible storyteller. And he's got amazing things to say about his own life. But also, if you're into Irish mythology, Mancán has got some incredibly interesting theories about Irish mythology based on his understanding of the Irish language. And he's got some theories about the roots of the fucking Irish language that are going to blow your head off. So, without further ado, here is my chat with Mancán. So, I suppose we'll crack into it. I want to kind of start on an autobiographical level, right? We're here to talk about your new book, right? Which is 32 words for field.
Yeah, but you just said that. You know the way you said, I want to kind of start with, but the way you said it made it sound exactly like a Wanachain, which is the evocative of my name, which was beautiful. It was like you delved into the most beautiful Irish. So you know the way there's a, you know, when you're calling someone's name, there's like a Hamas or a Fodric. But Mancán is my name, or Monachán. But then up in Donegal, it becomes a Wanachain or a Wanking, which is, you didn't quite go that far. But it was a lovely accidental Irish beginning to it.
One of your first books, right, were you, the travel books. I want to speak about your travel books first, right? Like, what's the journey? What do you hope? Do you say to yourself, right, I'm fucking off to America for 6 months and I'm just going to write about what I see? Do you have, like, what are you looking for there? Do you fear that you'll come away with nothing?
No. So what happened was, like, I was one of these kids who would have, like, heard voices in my head when I was young. Like, I was this idyllic little kid.
Literally, like as in mental illness?
No, not a mental illness, but nice voices. I mean, you know, someone could have called it a mental illness, but it was never... I mean, I did go to a psychiatrist, but I think that was because I was just anxious. No, I was... Like, I had this herb garden, so I didn't really fit in the real world. But I just had these gorgeous, like, you know, reassuring voices and words and dreams that I could escape into. And that works out really well. Basically, like one of those spiritual kids. And that works really well until you become about 18 or 19. And then, you know, suddenly the school tells you you're doing your leaving cert and you're going to have to, you know, get a job and you're going to have to get a mortgage and do that. And I realized that I couldn't do that. There was no way in my life that I could you know, knuckle down like that. Because so it was either these voices giving that freedom that I had, or otherwise it was depression. And so at the age of about 17 or 18...
Did the voices mean, is that like a calling? You felt the sense of a calling?
No, it didn't. It was just, I was really happy. I was deliriously happy and felt absolutely free.
Ah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I just felt there was no stopping me. I was like almost angelic, do you know? And then this mm-hmm. is, and you can believe like that in your in school, you can get away with it. Luckily, I didn't get bullied. I was just ignored. But then when they tell you have to go into the real world and, you know, do all these things, I thought I couldn't do that. And then depression comes. And you get that with a lot of these sort of, you know, dream-minded kids. So
the constrictions of society basically did not work with your personality, and the constrictions of society would bring on a sadness.
I didn't fit in, exactly. And so I fled. I knew that I'd end up in St. Pat's if I stayed in Dublin. And that would have been fine had I done that. But I realised that there was another way. And so I was... because my family were Republican revolutionaries back long ago,
mm-hmm.
we used to learn...
you've got a fucking serious lineage, man. Your granduncle is the O'Rahilly.
That was my great-granduncle.
Great-granduncle is the O'Rahilly. Yeah. And then Sheila Humphreys is your grandmother.
So, and then my grandfather was director of arms, Donal O'Donoghue, for the IRA.
Wow.
So there was a rule in the house, was you always learned French and German just so that you could import guns, if you know.
Yeah.
We've been doing that since about 1890. So luckily, I was brought up I left school in the 80s, where it was a recession. But because I had German and French, I was able to just go off to Germany and work in a hypermarket. So I had money at the age of 18 or 19. And I just went off. And then I could see with this money that there was trucks leaving, crossing Africa, going across Africa overland. And it was going to cost €1,000, £1,000 for the year, for 7 months. And I thought, this is it. I will finally be free. I'm going to understand that the bigger world is out there. I'll escape the claustrophobia and the confines of this suburban Dublin world. So I am... So that was the big idea. And I just went off to Africa. I was so desperate. It was this
far. What was your first trip, decent trip? Like, you went to Germany, but what was your first decent trip abroad where it's an artistic experience as such? You're going to not only travel, but experience and also journal your what's happening.
Yeah, so I was 19 years of age. It was about 2 months after the German trip. And I get on this truck, this ex-army overland truck that's leaving London and driving the whole way to Kenya. So it's going to go through France and Spain. It's going to go down through Morocco, through Algeria, to the center of the Sahara Desert.
But how do you even find that? How do you even find that, man?
Yeah, there were these little ads at the back of the British newspapers, of the Guardian or the Observer, and they said like $3,000 for 7 months. But I found a dirt cheap company that was doing it for $1,000 for the 7 months, and they just put 12 tents on board. They put 20 people. They just bought the truck from the British Army for about $7,000. Put I think 4-wheel drive tires on it, put sand mats, and just sent it off across Africa.
And who else was on this with you? Who are the type of people that want to do that?
Oh, that's a great question. They were not who I thought would be on it, would be other free-thinking, open-minded people who wanted to explore the world, other people who were as dreamy and idealistic and ridiculous as me. But it turned out, and they probably were on the trip that cost $3,000, but because I was on this $1,000 trip, it wasn't them. It was basically the dropouts, the dregs. All of us were just people who didn't function in society and people who wanted to escape. So there was one
escape.
Yeah, there was one bloke. He had been in the British Army 3 times in Northern Ireland, and there was a rule that if you ever went back the fourth time, you'd die. There was this superstition, and he had done things like in the first few days he'd be boasting to me, yeah, you know, we used to do this thing. He had a great idea. When Bobby Sands was on hunger strike, he would drive he'd hire a chipper van and drive it up to the ventilation shaft in Bobby Sands' cell. So that Bobby would be here, would be smelling like fresh fish and chips.
Oh my God.
And that was...
How did that feel to you, man? Like, your grandmother went on hunger strike.
Exactly. And I spent the 1980s helping my granny. She was still in contact with H Block and May's prisoners during the 80s. So, you know, the comms, these RISLA papers that were sent in and out of, she, when her eyesight got, you know, bad.
Oh, they used to write tiny little notes on RISLA papers and like hide them under fingernails or wherever you could fit them, basically.
Exactly. Swallow them or whatever. Yeah. But my granny would get these letters from the prisoners, and then she'd have to write back. But her eyesight wasn't so great anymore, so she'd like dictate the little letter to me, and I would then write it in minuscule handwriting on the Rizla paper.
One question there, Mancon. Well, so if your granny is like, so she's actively involved with communicating with the provisional IRA and provisional IRA prisoners, did that mean that you were being watched, or for you to like go to London and fuck off to Africa? Like, surely MI5 would be keeping an eye on you.
I mean, I was so innocent and young and 19. So my granny was living with us in the granny flat of our house in Dublin.
But she's being watched, surely.
She's being watched. That house was being watched. And, like, not only watched, but I remember during May's escape, you know, the special branch came to her door, because she'd had, in the past, she'd had prisoners that were on the run, H block prisoners that were on the run staying in the house. And it was sad, like, my dad was this Fine Gael, quiet Fine Gael farmer from the, well, you know, he was a doctor, but from a farming background from Longford, absolutely Redmondite, a committed pacifist. But of course, he marries into this Republican family, and this lovely house that he's bought, you know, in Dublin, he pays for the granny flat. And now my granny has these, you know, these prisoners hiding out in it. And the one time my dad was incredibly peaceful and, you know, just a quiet.
Did your
quiet
dad
man.
Know that these men were prisoners?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The only time I heard my dad roar was he went downstairs to check on my granny once. He'd say the rosary with her every evening in Irish. He even learned Irish just, you know, because the Irish was so important to the family. And he goes down and he recognizes who's hiding out in her coal hole. And he just screams, you know, "Not in my house," he says. So, yeah.
What, he recognized the person from the news, like?
Yeah. It wasn't good, like.
Holy fuck.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the way when you have a mother-in-law, you know, people say they have a problem with mother-in-law.
Well, I mean, people have problems with mother-in-laws, but if you're fucking, if you're hiding Martin McGuinness or something in a coal bunker,
yeah.
Different story, man.
Exactly.
So bringing over the wrong cake.
Yeah, so that, I mean, well, I'm getting distracted in one way, but that meant that my relationship with the Irish language was complicated. But I might go back to that in a second. But one reason that I fled, because I said I was this idealistic person, I go off to Africa, but there's a few reasons why I'm fleeing. Also because I realised this Irish language that I'd been given by my granny as this beautiful treasure and cultural sort of heirloom actually had an agenda, you know, that it was in some way a political weapon of war. So this would be why I would have, you know, gone off traveling. And I mean, that Africa trip turned out terrible. Everyone, like I mentioned, the bloke who was the British Army, but everyone was worse. There were people who had been embezzling, people else who were running away from tax fights. There were just the dregs. And our first day in Africa, we arrived in Morocco in the little town of Chef Chouan, having driven through France and Spain. And some of the Bedouins come up to offer us. We set up our tents, you know, the little old triangular army tents. Set a light of fire.
Were there any hash smugglers with you? That sounds like a hash smuggling type of thing.
There was no. To be fair, no, I was the only one who got involved with grass smuggling later. But there were none.
Okay.
No, they were all better. They were all fine in that terms. But there was. On the first day, anyway, this Bedouin came up to me and he said, came up to us all and he offers us firewood. And the others are just super disgusted and suspicious. And they just call him, they start calling him a raghead and said, "Get him away. All he'll do is dirty. He'll steal." And I realized I was stuck on this truck for 7 months with these absolute racists.
God.
Who only had English. And like 70% of those countries were French speaking countries. So it was a pretty dark trip. It turned out to be the best thing for me in my life. I had this utterly life-changing experience when we got to Zaire, to the Congo. And anybody that, you know, Zaire is the heart of darkness. It is where Conrad, where Kurtz got stuck. If you're ever going to have...
Roger Casement, man.
Exactly. If you're ever going to have a life-changing experience, it'll be in the Congo. We arrived there and we had this woman who was driving us, Belinda, an amazingly strong woman. I call her something else in the book. All she wanted to do was keep us alive. And she had done about 12 trips up until there, maybe, or seven, between 7 and 12 trips. And
what's the danger like here, Mancon? Like, what's the level of going into the Congo on the back of a truck? It to me, I'd be like, that sounds a bit scary, man.
So on all of her previous trips, someone had died. That's the level. One per-
like what type of death? Like, I mean, through disease, through being killed, through being kidnapped?
Mainly stupidity. You know, if the we are, as I said, the dregs of society. We're not the ones who know about Africa. We're not the ones who've read, who are careful. We're just people who are totally uncommitted, unkempt. So sometimes it was for... an old man just got a heart attack in the middle of the Sahara and they had to bury him there. Yeah. The time before that, she had begged them not to go on, not to take out the inner tubes from the truck and start, you know, riding the rapids on a river. And one person smashed...
What type of request? Don't take the tubes off the truck and go onto the river?
Yeah, yeah. They anyway, they did and they smashed. He smashed his head open. He died. So
Jesus.
Or otherwise it was just malaria or bilharzia or some disease. So
did you get your... like? I'm trying to gauge like the level of innocence that you'd gone into this situation. I mean, did you get your injections?
Yes, I did, actually. I never had injections after that in all of my other trips, but I did for that because I think they insisted on it. And so when we arrive anyway in Zaire, in the Congo, she has one other request for us, that none of us will ever buy or take drugs. Because, you know, every single military dictatorship there, all they're trying to do is get their hands on white people for some crime. And it's just so easy for them to find drugs on you.
Why is that? What's the incentive for them to capture a white person with drugs?
It's just, you know, they have no money. They want to get money. And the best way of getting bribes out of people is, you know, to get someone with a crime. And they actually have a crime. And then you have to pay big amount of bribes.
So we have a 19-year-old Irish lad here. We're going to sentence him to death. And now all of a sudden the UN is involved or something.
Exactly.
Wow, I never thought of it that way, man. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah, so exactly. So we arrive in Bumba, in Zaire, and, you know, now known as the Congo. And the first thing she's going to do, it's the only time she's going to leave us. Every trip, what she does is she leaves us to take a boat in a village called Bumba to take one of the great river journeys of the world. It goes from Kisangani or from Kinshasa to Kisangani. And it's this huge floating market. And just this one tug, an old German riverine tug, and these steel platforms. And we slowly go down the way. And there's no roads in this area. So all of the local tribespeople come out of the Amazon, of the equatorial jungle, and they trade their crocodile skins and monkeys or whatever potions they have with you. And she thought, like, this is a journey, it's an experience you cannot miss. So she leaves us there that day. And she leaves us just enough money and just enough, you know, malaria tablets and all to do us the 5 days. We're going to be on the river before we reach her in Kisangani, which was the old Stanleyville, from Leopoldville to Stanleyville.
Mm-hmm. And the rubber plantations.
Exactly. The darkest shit of slavery and human trafficking. And so that first day, we rent out two rooms in just this old shack, and we all sleep on the floor of the two rooms. Like, at this stage, we've been 3 months in a tent. So you know, sleeping on the floor of a room was luxury. And I went out, and just to my utter just ignorance and stupidity, someone offered me, it was actually a plastic bag, like a Spar or a Super Value bag of cannabis. It was a pure shopping bag of cannabis. I think it was
it hash or weed?
It was weed. It was weed.
Okay.
Very heavy crystal weed, like, but loads of bush, lovely. But loads of sticks and everything else to it. But anyway, I brought this home back to the shack we were in. And by this stage, a huge divide had entered the group. Those who never wanted to talk to any African or engage were absolutely petrified. And the others wanted to do a bit. And we, anyway, the ones who were willing to engage a bit, we smoked some of that. But it turned out to be somehow laced with something. It just made us all hallucinate a lot. Mm-hmm. And we woke up the next day. We conked out, woke up the next day, and everything we owned was stolen from us. Everything.
Wow. Okay.
Now, any old Africa hand, anyone who understands Africa, realizes immediately exactly what happened. I didn't know this for weeks. You're in a military dictatorship. A military dictatorship, the military control everything. They see every foreigner. They see every person who comes in, particularly a foreigner. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who give you the drugs. Of course they are. The ones that are going to knock you out, and then they're going to take all your money. But I didn't know that. So I innocently went down to the police station next day.
Dear God.
There was no police station. Turned out it was just a military encampment. And they were just stoned to their eyeballs on things. And this man, Hercule, I explained to him in French what's happened. And he says, you know, this is terrible. It's a catastrophe. Don't worry. You will now see Zairean justice. And he went down to the local sort of township. and the ghetto, and he just randomly picked three boys, dragged them back. He got his army, his soldiers to drag them back, and they started beating them in front of me, beating them over the head with the butt of his rifle. And again, I was this innocent kid. I had no knowledge how to deal with this. And eventually I begged him. I said, I don't want that. I just want to find our passports. But when they got sort of so exhausted from beating, they sent us away again. And we went back the next day and said, you know, have you found the things? And after the next day, they said no. The next day, they said they need money.
We had no money.
They said they needed, you know, money even just to get diesel to put into the Jeep to look for the robbers. We had no money, but we begged the other 10 people, you know, the other half of the group who hated us, to give us their money. And anyway, we got locked into this thing that it was between about a week without. Eventually, our money ran out after about 3 days. We gave it all to them. There was no signs of passport. And this is, you cannot move anywhere without your passport. You cannot go, you know, by this stage we had no malaria tablets.
I'm guessing there's no Irish embassy to call up, or what's the crack?
There was nothing. No, the only embassy was down in South Africa at the time. We thought, okay, we'll find another way out. But
are we talking the 80s here or the 90s?
We're talking 89/90. So the Gulf War had just begun. Okay, Desert Storm was going on. And so what happened was that all of the countries, about a week before this happened, all of the Arabic countries around us, Algeria and others, Tunisia, had all closed their borders. So no one was getting through. So actually, normally there would be another NGO or charity group or either an overland truck behind you, but there was none of those. And then we also realized that there was no no diesel in the country. Like, this is the last days of Mobutu, the dictator Mobutu's regime. The entire country was bankrupt. So there was no money, there was no diesel, there was no way out. We were the only truck to have come through, foreigner truck to have come through in 3 months.
And what emotions are going through your body at that point?
Well, the weirdest thing was, We only went there because Belinda had told us the river barge was coming the next morning, and we were going to get on that river barge for the 5 days. So next morning, when we realise we're robbed, the other 10 people go down to the river to get on the river barge. But they realise the river barge wasn't there, and the river barge wouldn't come, and it hadn't been there for 2 months because there was no diesel, and it couldn't be there for another 3 months because the dry season had come early. So Belinda had lied to us. She had gone down to the port to check it was there, and actually had abandoned us on purpose and fled with the truck. So it was really, really dark. So we couldn't even ask her for help. There was no way of getting any help.
And did you, one little thing that's popping up for me too is when you spoke earlier there about there a divide is emerging between you and the group.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I find interesting is when I hear about, we'll say, the English people not wanting to speak with the locals, being racist. Did you find, did anything colonial come up in you? Did you reflect on the fact that you don't come from a colonial culture and these people do come from a colonial culture and this is now being reflected in your actions, or were they just a shower of cunts?
No, I mean, I totally heard that. Like, the pride they had about getting to Uganda and Kenya and Tanzania, the places that had been colonized by the English, it was all about this idea that we are superior, we are a colonial race. You know, and I mean, I was called Paddy, and sort of, you know, there was all those sort of jokes about me drinking and things were there. It was just classic. That mindset that is in, a large swathe of England was very strong.
Because, like, the moment you said the Congo to me, the first thing that comes up to my head, it's Roger Casement. Mm. And then I get this lovely feeling of Roger Casement was the one to highlight the crimes that happened here. So my association with a place like that, I get this lovely wholesome feeling in my heart of the Irish impact on the Congo is one of compassion and calling out injustice.
Absolutely, absolutely. But we saw that at every single border we passed, we saw that, because the visas that the English people were having to pay were about two or three times as high as mine. In fact, a lot of my visas were free. And they never tweaked
because
why this...
the African people are going, this fella's Irish.
Exactly. Wherever I went, I was just welcomed. It was that lovely feeling you get. That has
another thing I'd love to ask you about, Mancon, is so one thing that I'm fascinated with, and I've a feeling you'd know a good bit about it. Are you familiar with Bob Quinn's Atlantean theory and the relationship between Ireland and Africa? Historically,
I am indeed. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's very rich.
I'm fascinated with that, right? Did your trip to Africa, what do you think about that? Can you explain for the listeners what the Atlantean theory of Irish origin is and reflecting it regarding your journeys to Africa.
Yeah, one good way of looking at it is even, a lot of people know, you know, that the Irish word for a black person is Fear Gurum. And,
yes,
you know, there's a few different theories.
The blue man.
Exactly, the blue man. There's a few different theories. Some people would say because, you know, dove, black is always connected with the devil and is always dark things. And even a black horse would never have been called couple dove, but it was called couple down mostly. But there's mm-hmm. another theory for that. And that is the Irish people would have known black people. Like there was mm-hmm. Berber monkey.
Navan Fort.
Exactly. Yeah.
They found that there's a skull of a monkey fucking 2,000 years old.
Exactly, that's it, yeah. Which, you know, most likely that came from North Africa, could have been the one that came from Gibraltar, but it was from Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And then even in a bog in Offaly, there was a Bible with papyrus papers, clad in papyrus papers. Mm-hmm. So either that book was either brought from Egypt, or at least the papyrus definitely came from Egypt. So we know there was contact. I mean, we just know that the roots were, you know, what Bob Quinn saw so easily was that there are these amazing trade routes. It is very easy to go from the west of coast of Ireland, from the Aran Islands, mm-hmm. down along France and Spain, and then right around into the Mediterranean where you get to Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And even like in the Pharaoh's time, there was a canal that linked, before the Suez Canal, you know, that links the mm-hmm. Mediterranean with the Red Sea. There was, the Pharaohs had systems of canals. They didn't ever last very long because the sand would pile in again. But there were ways of getting in ancient times to the Red Sea and to, you know, to get to the Far East. So we know the Irish people were amazing sailors. We know they were going up to the Faroes, going up to Greenland, maybe even going across to North America.
And how long ago are we talking here? Are we going back 1,000 years, 2,000 years?
Yeah, so, I mean, let's say with that Bible, we're going just 1,500 years. As you said, mm-hmm. with Navan Fort, you're going down 2,000 years. And after yeah. that, there's no sort of historical record, but we just know. Well, the next link you're going is, you know, the likes of the Passage Graves, Newgrange, you're going, yeah. you know, 4,500 BC. What Bob Quinn showed so clearly, like if you go to Tunisia and you go to Morocco, you're seeing those same standing stones, you know, these mm-hmm. monoliths, you're seeing stone circles, you're seeing the remains of passage grave type buildings, and they are identical to the ones that are found in Ireland, in Cornwall, and in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, it could just about be coincidence, but it's a weird coincidence. It seems there was this common culture. So the Bedouins too.
And Quinn's theory, Quinn goes straight. Quinn just says that Irish people are essentially African people. That he says that we don't come from Europe, that we come from Africa via the sea.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and like, so, you know, I've just done a TV series on ancient DNA. And, you know, what it's showing now mm-hmm. is that the original settlers of Ireland were dark brown skinned, brown-haired and blue-eyed. Now that mix doesn't mm-hmm. exist in the world anymore, but it was a people that were found in sort of Egypt and in the Middle East. So we know mm-hmm. for certain from DNA evidence that the first people who came here were people basically from Egypt and from the Middle East, you know, who'd come out of Africa.
Took the Atlantic route.
Exactly.
So Bob Quinn is finally, because the thing with me and Bob Quinn, whenever I would bring Bob Quinn up with historians, mm-hmm. he was kind of rubbished as a kind of a fanciful thinker.
Yeah, it was finally about 4 years ago, Michael Viney did a great article where he just said, look, this is the proof. It has been shown by the latest sort of technology in DNA sequencing that he was right all along.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So those first people who, as I said, were blue-eyed and
brown-skinned. What other connections is there, Mancon? Is it, I've heard like Shano singing and similarities with Shano singing and almost Islamic call to prayer from North Africa and stuff.
Yeah, and again, you know, it's hard to definitely prove these things, but just listen to the two. Listen to the Shano sing, and then, as you said, the call to prayer, Arabic sing. It's these long cadences, this sort of rolling on a vowel. But there's words, like the Irish for confidence or trust is muneen. And if you mm-hmm. the Arabic word is muinna. The Irish for knife is skian. And if you go to any Arabic country, they'll tell you it's either sikian or sikina or sikina. But maybe most strongly, or gara. Gara is to cut, you know, in Irish. And gara is to cut in Arabic. Kala, an Irish for port. Chala is the Arabic for port. But maybe mm-hmm. the most strongest of all is the shamrock. Our ultimate symbol of Irishness, you know, shown on St. Patrick's Day. It's the shamrogue or the shammer. But it happens to be the exact same word in the Arabic word of shamrak, and it's shamrak in pre-Islamic Arabic culture. In other words, in pagan Arabic culture, a shamrak was a particular three-leafed plant, okay? A three-leaf plant, and each one of the petals of that leaf represented one of the pagan gods. Like, are you going to say that's coincidence that it happens that pre-Arabic, pre-Islamic Arabic culture has this called shamrak, a leaf that represents the tree? We know tree was the key moment, key idea in pagan Irish or pagan early Irish and Celtic belief, and they happen to use the same word for it. Like, that's uncanny.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, and it's nothing weird. We know that we were, everybody, you know, that we were trading people, that people migrated constantly. I think in, so, you know, this book I've written, The 32 Words for Field, I look at that. But the thing that blew me away most was the connections between Ireland and India. Like, they are just so strong. And again, why would you have these connections?
And that baffles me. Like, that's fucking baffling.
Yeah.
That's quite far apart.
And again, we just need to get out of our mindset. We are so in the mindset of nationalism. In fact, we're coming to the last, to the death grasps of nationalism now. Previously, people were a migratory people who just moved and travelled depending on the circumstances. And it looks like we're going back towards that. So it makes absolutely sense that all cultures would have been interlinked. But why particularly was India and Ireland, why are the connections so strong? And it's really because, you know, we know that we're sort of an Indo-European culture. So our culture sort of came from the basically the middle of Europe, or more towards the east of Europe, and the Europe to the Middle East, okay, that area. Now, that culture, that sort of Celtic culture or Indo-European culture, which our language is based on, was pushed to the margins, okay? That's why the Irish language is still to be found only in the north of Scotland and, you know, the west of Ireland, and then places like Poitou, like Brittany and Galicia.
Wow.
But then that's...
So you think of it as something continually and consistently being pushed west.
Exactly. Being pushed west and being pushed east. So that same culture, all of the same elements of it are still...
Holy fuck.
Yeah, they're still alive, which is why you will get, like, the Brehon laws are, like, identical to a lot of the old Indian laws. Why the word Ara, the noble person, you know, or Ara, a minister in the government, is the same word as Arya, a noble in the in Sanskrit. Or why Brehav and Braham and Brahman are the same word, the same root.
Jesus.
They come from Brih, from mantras. Or even Idas, you know, Idachas or Idas, the learning. That's the same word as the Vedas, the Indian Vedas, which is, you know, the Indian lore, the central lore. And that Veda, again, even the word Druid, comes from Dru, an oak, and then Vid, which is the Veda, the learning that is connected to the oak, which is the central
Holy
core.
Fuck.
Like, we are the same people. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Now, one thing, when I hear the term Vedas, that's like one of the earliest religions that we know of. And it's also one of these religions that quantum physicists and the people who are at the cutting edge of physics, who are trying to understand the nature of what reality is, and like things like reality being a simulation, they'll often say it has a lot of similarities to real early Vedic scriptures and their view of the universe. Yeah. Have you studied or looked at any, I don't know, ancient Irish religious, but like pre-Christian Irish religious views? Are they similar to Vedic stuff? Is there anything going on there?
So as you said, like there are Brahmins, very early type of Brahmins, chanting in parts of Kerala and Tamil Nadu in the south of India, in the forest there. And the mantras they have, the chants they have, aren't words. We don't understand them anymore. They are pre that. They're almost, what linguists say is they could be the sounds that were based on the first guttural sounds the humans made before they developed linguistics.
But developed language.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Now, it's hard to find that same level of ancientness in Irish or even in the sounds that made up Irish. Like, one of the things that I'm trying to get at in the book is that Irish, like, you know, we sort of know that the Celtic culture only arrived in Ireland. That culture, that Indo-European culture that went to India, came to Ireland. It only came here probably about 500 BC. So 2,500 years ago.
Here's a big question for you. Is it, when people say the Irish are Celts, is that naive or incorrect?
No, it's correct. So what we do know is that the people who built, so those first blue-eyed hunter-gatherer people, the blue-eyed, really dark-skinned people, they're not us. Mm-hmm. They were hunter-gatherers who came here and they were wiped out, okay? Then mm-hmm. the next tribe...
Oh, fuck, okay.
Yeah, we killed, well, we might have killed them, or probably temperature, you know, conditions killed them. The next group of people were the people who built Newgrange and, you know, mm-hmm. the Nowth and Douth and Loch Crewe and all of these amazing places. Obviously incredibly sophisticated people who understood astronomy. They're not us. Yeah. They're not us either. There's almost no DNA connection between us and them. They died out too. An incredibly complex community culture that, I mean, there's a trace elements of them still in us, but not much. Mm-hmm. That Neolithic culture, there's not very much of it in our DNA. So who we are mm-hmm. is we're the Bronze Age people, the people who came after that. We were brought farming and we brought knowledge of bronze from, again, the Middle East, from North Africa area. And then we're them. And then we were mixed. We were joined by these Celts who arrived. So because those people, the Bronze Age people, would have come like 4,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago. Then the Celtic or Gaelic people came 2,500 years ago. So we're a mix between those Bronze Age people and that new culture that came in. But you know, as you say, this idea of the Vedic and that knowledge. So in our language, it's hard to get a sense of the sounds that came. But definitely there are words in Irish that make it clear that our mindset before modernity took over totally accepted that sort of quantum nature, that otherworldly sense of there being no limitation to the physical reality. Like there's a word in Irish called crihir. And crihir means a tiny particle. Or a spark of flame, or a light, or a tiniest portion of something. But it can also mean a subatomic particle, and it can mean mm-hmm. vulnerability, the vulnerability and the insubstantiality of solid objects. So when we look at the world now in our rational objective mind, our pre or post-Newtonian world, we think of everything as solid. But of course, a people who believed in the other world, who believed in Kyantar, which is this area, this region, this place, and Altar, which is the other world, and there was always only a thin veil between the two, for them it was clear that things could look solid, but could also be utterly insubstantial.
So, and quantum physics today will tell you that solidity is an illusion. Everything is made up of essentially waves, quantum waves.
Exactly. Yeah. So you know, crihir can be a swamp. It can be the trembling of the land. It can be an earthquake. It can be the crumbling surface of cloud land when dry after rain. It's basically accepting that idea of quantum, that the things can be solid and not solid at the same time.
Oh, the ambiguity.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah.
Going to take a slight break from the interview now. To do our ocarina pause. I've got a shaker and an ocarina this week. Each week we have a little pause in the podcast because advertisements are digitally inserted into this podcast by Acast, and I don't want an advert coming in and giving you a fright. So what I like to do is give you a little bit of a warning. So we're going to have a combined shaker and ocarina pause, so when an advert comes in you don't get startled.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So that was a digitally inserted advert right there that was put in by Acast. I don't know what it was because they're algorithmically generated. So the adverts that you get are going to be different to the advert that your friend gets, depending on what you're looking for on your phone. That's how it works.
If you're hearing more adverts than usual, that's because of coronavirus. I think advertisers are putting more ads on podcasts because people are listening to podcasts more during coronavirus. All right. If I want this podcast to be hosted, I don't want to be hosting it myself, not with the amount of listeners I have. If I want free hosting, then adverts are a necessary evil that have to go into the podcast. But outside of that, this is a 100% independent podcast. No advertiser tells me what the fuck to do. And if I don't want an advertiser on this podcast, I can tell them to fuck off with no ramifications, because this is a listener funded 100% independent podcast that gives me full editorial control over what this is and what it's about. So all I'm asking is, if you're enjoying this podcast, right, it's like 5 hours of fucking content a month. All I'm looking for is, give me the price or a price of a pint or a cup of coffee once a month and pay me for the work I'm doing at patreon.com/theblindboypodcast. This is my career. It's how I earn a living. Can't do gigs because of coronavirus. And you really are helping me by becoming a patron. If you can't afford it, don't worry about it. This is a model that's based on kindness and soundness. People who can afford it become patrons. People who can't afford it listen for free. And by becoming a patron, you're paying for someone else to listen for free if they can't afford it. Everyone's happy. Everyone gets a podcast. And I earn a living. Fucking lovely. Patreon.com/theblindboypodcast. Subscribe to the podcast. Like it. Tell a friend about it. Also, join me on Twitch. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night at 8:30 p.m. Irish time. I'm on Twitch, twitch.tv/theblindboypodcast. And I'm doing an interesting project where I'm making a live musical to video games, but also chatting. You can come on live and chat with me live and have some crack. All right, Yart. Back to the conversation with Mancon.
So one thing that I've heard before is, have you looked into the influence of we'll say, psychedelic drugs like mushrooms and things like that on ancient Irish cultures? Like, I've heard that if you look at the art that's on the front of Newgrange, especially the abstract art they were making, the lozenges and the spirals, that was the type of vision one would receive if they were to eat the type of mushrooms that grow out of cow shit around that area.
Yeah, so, and I heard Billy Maughlin discussing this with you, and he does it with such control, you know, because there's a degree of uncertainty about all these things, yet, and yet all are potentials. So What do we know? Like, we know, for example, that look at the folklore, you know, the main idea of Finn McCool getting the wisdom, the salmon of knowledge. And how does he do that? He goes to Cunla's well, or there's a few different water sources that he goes to. He picks up the salmon, he burns himself, he cooks the salmon and creates a blister, or he burns himself. And that word for the blister is called bullag is, bubble of insight or bubble of knowledge. And it's also used for the words of the hazelnuts that drop from this magic tree that is over Cunn as well. And when the bubble of knowledge, or also it's called Cno Crihin, which is sort of a hazel of insight. And it falls into the water and it makes the water magic. And so when the salmon is in, it makes the salmon magic. And so when Finn McCool gets it, he either sucks, and so it's a bubble of knowledge, a bullagis or a krill krimmond, a hazel of knowledge. And then when he gets it, he gets another bubble of knowledge, the blister of knowledge, which again, bubble and blister is the same word. It's all bullagis. And that word bullag is also used for some particular type of mushrooms, because of course, those two were known to impart wisdom and to impart magic.
And when they say wisdom, immediately what I'm hearing is people who have psychedelic experiences, DMT, ayahuasca, and then they come back from it with a greater knowledge and understanding of self and reality, as is often reported.
Exactly.
So are you saying that, like, you reckon there's a way to interpret the story of the salmon of knowledge, where it's like Fionn McCool just did a lot of mushrooms and met the elves in the machine?
It's a shamanic trip, exactly. And like, why is it the Bredon? Why is it the salmon? The salmon is a speckled animal.
Yeah.
What else
is... And salmons don't eat acorns. That's one thing. I know the salmon's... Here's two things that keep me awake at night about that story. Mm. The salmon's name is Fintan, which is a ridiculous name for a fish. And then secondly, he eats acorns.
Yeah, but you know, you do know what Finn means in Sanskrit and in early Irish. It means the wise one. It means white. It means seeing through. It means seeing through the darkness to the light. You know, like Boin, the Boin River. You know, the Boin River, which is the white cow goddess. The Boin River is you know, the river was so sacred that she was represented. Well, the Boin or the Boinda was the most sacred goddess in early Irish culture, and she was represented in physical form by the Boin River. And so she is so luminous.
That's not the same cow that's up in the stars, is it?
Exactly, exactly. So luminous was she. Yeah,
because Billy, who we were talking about there,
yeah,
he's got some stone in his garden or something, but up in the stars, using some ancient fucking Celtic archaeology or something, there's the Milky Way. Was the Milky Way referred to as a cow or something in ancient Irish astronomy?
You have it, you have it. So the Boyne River, okay. The Boyne River is so nourishing. So the Boyne God is a mother goddess, okay, the Boinda. Mm-hmm. She's a mother goddess. She nourishes her people with her milk. Now, she is mm-hmm. represented in physical form by the river of the Boyne, which nourishes its people with the water, okay? And mm-hmm. so powerful is she that at night she shines up into the night sky and becomes the Milky Way, Balach na Bo Finna, the way of the white cow. Exactly. Now,
so this is what has me interested now. So the ancient Irish are referring to this as cow, as milk. How in English are we looking up at the Milky Way and referring it to the way of milk, the fucking milk highway?
Isn't it lovely? Isn't it lovely the way some trace of the knowledge gets kept, but then it sort of gets, you know, mushed up and confused. But just to finish that point, the final things I love about that is that if you ask people long ago about Knowth and Douth and Newgrange, the prehistoric tombs along mm-hmm. along the Boyne, they will tell you that they thought that they were mirror image of planet constellations. So not only is the Boyne River being reflected up in the night sky to create the Milky Way, but actually some of those star constellations are then being mirrored back in the land in stone and circular form. On into the ground. And the final thing of that is Boinda, the mother goddess, the most powerful god, she's the exact same god as Govinda, as the Indian form of Krishna. So Bo is a cow in Irish, as we know. Go is a cow in Sanskrit. Vinda is a finder, a looker, a seeker. It is like the same culture, the same gods. We are one.
And when you're studying this stuff, are you coming at this from the position, like, you're not an academic, are you?
I am not, no. I have no expertise in anything.
So no. You're just a curious person looking into this shit. Like, do you ever take this stuff and try and, like, go to academics? Like, how these are essentially hunches that you have, and it's overwhelming. Like, it's phenomenal. As you said, it's like, how the fuck can this be a coincidence? But how does it go from this wonderful coincidence into being something that's accepted or has research put behind it, and something that then becomes truth?
Mm. What is that? Truth is not above reason but beyond it. Like, so I, as I said, we started this with, I was a disillusioned kid with an over idealistic kid. I went off traveling, mm-hmm. I went off to Africa, I went off to South America, and I went off eventually to India, moved into an old cow shed and like spent about 8 months there going to parts of my brain that one shouldn't really have access to. I sort of dropped out.
Tell us about that. Tell us about being in a cow shed in India and visiting dirty parts of your brain.
I will. Well, I'll finish what I was saying. I will though.
Go on.
So, and I wanted to make sense of my life, you know. So after I came home from India, and I'll explain that, I built my little straw bale house in Westmeath, and I just, the world didn't make sense. I wanted to make sense. What I want from this book I've written is just, people are lost. People are disillusioned and disconnected. It just happens that our culture and our language and our old religions and beliefs can root us back into the world to make sense of who we are, of what we are in this chaotic, crazy world. So I don't want to engage with academia. Like, I did a degree in UCD years ago in Irish. And at the end, I remember the professor said to me, I see a great career for you in academia. No one has looked at the GH, you know, in the genitive of Donegal Irish. And that's mm-hmm. a world we don't need to cross into. Luckily, Billy McGlynn can manage the two things. He can do academia mm-hmm. and he can do the walk the wild side. But what I want is to bring these ideas out because they'll nourish us. They'll make sense of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But should I tell you about India? Go on.
I'd love to know about India. What, like, because, like, actually, how did Africa end? How did you, like, you were stuck in the Congo, your passport is gone, and now you're here on a podcast talking to me. So what happened that you ended up things working out all right?
I got, that 5 days or 7 days in Zaire, we went without food, we went without water. That was the best time of my life. I suddenly realized I know now why I'm alive. I felt more vibrant and more alive. And I thought, I want to live a life which is does not have rules or limitations, that based on my greatest aspirations. And that's partly because I was just, you know, a teenager with two big ideas. But maybe, and also we were slowly working our way through the bag of cannabis. That could have helped just to alleviate the pain, the hunger pangs. But in that, on Zaire, I ended up getting bilharzia, which was no cure for. I had to drink the river water of the Congo, and it had.
You got what?
It bilharzia. It's this little slug or snail that goes into your body, into an orifice, and it slowly does you no harm for the first few years. But every year, it creates a little shell around itself, and it goes into your kidney and it creates a shell around your kidney, and eventually it turns your whole kidney into stone. Basically, it's like the Gargan from the outside. It turns you into stone. And there was no cure for it at the time. But luckily, I came back and my mom insisted I go to the Tropical Medical Bureau. And they had a cure was invented about 2 months later. And so I was cured.
So, oh, wow. Okay.
So then I go back to finish my degree. I go back and do 2 years in college. And then I go off to Africa. Sorry, to South America. And I ended up running a hostel on the Ecuador, on an organic farm on the Ecuador-Peruvian border, in a place that was famous for San Pedro, for this mescaline cactus. Mm-hmm. And the Israeli soldiers used to all come straight off after their 3 or 4 years conscription and come to my place to take this San Pedro.
So were you running like a retreat where people could do San Pedro cactus?
No, I was just asked to look after the hostel and the farm, the farm workers.
Okay.
And it turned out that
people happened to go there for San Pedro.
Yeah, but we'd always tell them not to take that on the land, and we wouldn't give them information about where it was got. But they would go off into the forest. But eventually people would have bad trips, and I would be called upon to hike up into the Amazonian cloud forest and take them back from the tree. They'd either strip naked or thrown all their money away. And then I'd have to ring up the Israeli embassy and say, you know, one of your kids has gone missing. It's meant ever since I have huge sympathy for Israel, just because those kids who become the worst aggressors of Palestinians, I just saw they were mixed up teenagers, you know, who didn't know how to say no. And their lives were ruined for the oppression and the brutality that they had inflicted.
To be institutionalized into becoming killers, essentially.
Exactly.
Unthinking killers, uncaring.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, I finished, but I was trying to search for something that made sense to my life in Africa. I failed, I got distracted. In South America, I got distracted. And so eventually my sort ends up in India.
What is the nature of a distraction for you?
I believed that there was God inside me. I believed that there was this source of utter creativity and love and you know, assurance. And so, you know, you just get caught up in conventional thinking or self-doubt or just, you know, distractions of, you know, I think drugs is a distraction. I think gossip is a distraction. Mm-hmm. I think loads of things is a distraction. I wanted to just get in touch with my mind. So
how were you for drink? What was your relationship with drink like?
I had no luckily I can just drink 2 pints and I don't have a need to drink more.
Okay, yeah.
And I never took huge amounts of cannabis, or, you know, despite those my cannabis stories. Before India, I ended up on a big organic cannabis farm looking after the children in Vancouver in British Columbia. Mm-hmm. So there was always, just because cannabis, people who are thinking left field, who are marginal liminal thinkers, tend to be in that world. But I wasn't particularly interested in the drugs. So, and I went off to India, determined to find a cave in the Himalayas, because I heard, you know, that's where the purest energy was. And someone told me,
well, hold on a second, how do you hear there's a cave in India with pure energy? I'm off there. Like, what do you mean?
Well, a tightrope walker, a French tightrope walker from the circus I met in Colombia. And he told me about this. That was after, anyway, I won't get into it. You know the Screamers in Ireland, the only primary cult, the primary.
No, I don't.
I'll tell you another time. I spent time with them in South America. But this tightrope walker from France told me about this place called Papazali or Almora. And he said, if you go there, make sure you have a return ticket, because otherwise you will never leave, he said. Make sure.
Wow.
And so I immediately went to India. That's when as soon as I got home from South America, earned another, maybe did 6 months in a supermarket in Germany to earn more money. And went off there and Of course, I only took a single ticket. There was no way. I did not want to leave if I found this bliss. And I tried to find the cave, and I couldn't find that cave or any cave.
You'd know internet. This is pre-internet.
Yeah, exactly. This was 96. So I suppose a few people had internet.
So are you arriving in India saying a French tightrope walker told me in South America that there's this cave, and you had to rely upon the local people to know if the cave existed?
Yes, and it wasn't so hard before the internet because of that backpacker system. Like, I could still,
okay,
I could find anyone in any country in the world. I know that, but you just go, you pick up a copy of Lonely Planet, you go to those places they're in. We're all talking about the same things. It's a total third, it's a different university. Like, prison is a university. That backpacking circuit for new thinking and concepts, like everything, I have no mortgage. I live in a straw bale house. I am utterly free. All of that I learned backpacking. People tell you the secrets of not, you know, I didn't want to get tied down to the system. I learned how not to traveling. So all I need to do is arrive in Delhi, talk to a few people in a hostel. They'll put you onto someone else. You'll find someone else. And I heard about someone who was, I heard about an immortal yogi who was 180 years living in one cave. I was going to visit him. And you hear about people. So I go up to Almora. And at the same time, though, there was an Indian man, it was a German man who knew India, and he happened to tell me that there was a leper station up there, and he wanted me to check on the leper station to see how I was. So in the end, he gave me a job in the leper station as chief medical officer. I had no knowledge of medicine. So I ended up in Almora. I was a chief officer of a leper station, and although because I couldn't find the cave, I found a cow
shed.
What
were your responsibilities? If you're the chief officer of a leper station, what are your responsibilities there? I mean, are you given any resources? I mean, leprosy is contagious as well, isn't it?
It is. It's pretty contagious, but it's very easy to cure now, thanks to a tablet invented by an Irishman in Trinity College in the 50s called Wunto. It's now multi-therapy remedies, three different types. He invented one. All you need to do is take those tablets for 6 weeks and you're cured. The problem is no one wants to be cured. In India particularly, or in Africa, or in any other culture, in all of the holy books, leprosy is the disease that is mentioned most in the holy books. So you are most likely to get alms and charity if you have leprosy. So the lepers in India.
Oh my God! So is it a system of poverty that's so great that if you become a leper, you might more likely get room and board or food?
You're sorted. Your needs are sorted forever. You'll always get alms if you're a leper. So, and particularly it's complicated because in India, there's the karmic idea. You have been given leprosy in this lifetime. It is not up to you to interfere with the god's destiny and cure that leprosy. But of course, the German man who told me about this leper station, he had a rational Western mindset and he knew he could cure these people in 6 weeks. So all I had to do was once every 10 days, go down to Almora and oversee them. It was in Pepper's Alley. Go down to Pepper's Alley and watch the people take the tablets, force them basically to take their tablets. And I'd do that every 10 days. Luckily, they were far cleverer than me. They'd always either spit it out or throw it down. No one ever got cured in my whatever, 7 months there. So I do that. And meanwhile, because I couldn't find a cave, I found a cow shed. So once every 10 days, I'd go down to the leper station. And otherwise...
Did the cave ever exist?
Oh, yeah, there's plenty. So Gandhi went up and meditated in a cave in this area. Like a lot of the great gurus went up to this area. It's an area...
But did this particular cave that the French tightrope walker told you about, was that a real cave or was it like many caves?
I wasn't quite sure. People were telling me I knew of four different hermits and anchorites who were living in different caves above me in the area, but I could find no cave that was free that I could move into.
Now, here's another question I just want to ask you about caves and meditation.
Yeah.
So I went up to a cairn up in Sligo. Is it Knocknarea?
Yeah. Well, Knocknarea is Queen Maeve's Hill, but it's the one, is the cairn, Carrowkeel and the other Carrowmore.
I can't think of the name of it.
It's right
Carrowmore. That makes sense now.
Right beside Knocknarea. Yeah, you can see that.
And I didn't know much about cairns, and I went. I was in Sligo on a gig, and I was bored, and I said, "Fuck it, we'll go up there," and I didn't know what to expect. And it was. I've got tinnitus now, but it was before I had tinnitus, and I walked into the cairn, and I experienced a silence that I'd never known. Like this freaky silence. And I asked someone there and they said, yeah, that they said that they used to meditate in there, that the stones are arranged so that you experience this extreme silence so that you can be alone in your meditation. Is that why these caves, is that what was special about these caves? Was it an auditory thing?
That too. So, you know, and science is now showing that if we put the right resonance into our head, and those, they say that Loch Crew and the other caves in Ireland are tuned to that resonance, that it actually, you can track with an MRI machine that it changes the brain patterns of our brain and brings us to an awareness that sort of alpha waves, more alpha waves than beta or something, so that we have a grander awareness. So that is definitely an element. We can change our consciousness by vibrating in the right space. And all these caves seem to have been created in such a way that it can do that. But I think in the Himalayas, the reason why, like, I genuinely did, I think I got enlightenment, or any wisdom I now have, I got it in India. And why does everyone get it in India? Why did I get distracted? And did I forget my search in Africa, forget my search in South America, got it in India? Some people say it's the rocks. There is some type of electromagnetic frequency in the Himalaya, in the rocks in the Himalayas. And again, you can now calculate that using high-tech sensors. And it sort of facilitates the mind to open up different elements of it. And that would have sounded hippy-dippy, but actually scientists are now proving this in MRI labs. You put different frequencies into the brain and suddenly different parts of the brain are tuned up and open to things. So I think that's why the cave is
important. Look, I'd be with it. I'm someone who meditates and look, shit's happened to me during meditation. Awareness is, like, I'm not someone who does psychedelics, but I've had experiences with meditation that sound like when people describe ayahuasca. I'd be meditating and all of a sudden I awaken from it with this deep understanding of oneness. I remember coming out of a meditation once, and the first thing, as I opened my eyes, it was by a river. I saw a nettle and I just felt extreme love for this nettle. A real empathy and understanding that whatever the fuck me and the nettle were, it was the same. You know what I mean?
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, exactly. God.
And you know what I mean? It's like I just sat down for 20 minutes and was with my own thoughts. And now all of a sudden, a nettle feels like a family member. And it was real.
Whoa. Yeah. And I believe, and I know I'm distracted, is that the Irish language also has that idea, just in a single word, in many words, like in the word like skim. So skim means a tiny speck of flour, but it also can mean a tiny piece of dust or any small particle. And it can mean whitewash on a wall, and it can mean a dust on a mantelpiece. But skim has also these, so you've got all these things, basically a tiny particle, again, like the Creator, it could be a subatomic particle, but also means, it means a fairy film that covers the land, and it means succumbing to the supernatural world through sleep. So one word can bring
a fairy film. Is this like, I had Eddie Lenihan on, he was speaking about like a goo that fairies leave in areas.
No, sorry, I have the wrong word. I suppose a film, more a veil, more a sort of a go, you know, that haze in the early morning that you see, that makes you feel that the world is, you're seeing beyond. It just seems, that the edges are a bit mushy.
It's the magical hour of the morning, the early morning when things feel magical and breathy.
Exactly, and that you can almost pass through the physical into another realm. Exactly, that thing. But the cave, so as you said, so Mike, I couldn't find a cave, so I found a cow shed. So what I would do instead is all day I'd walk in the Himalayas, where in the rhododendron forest. The rhododendron grow the size of trees over there. And I'd grow there and then I'd get back into my cow shed at night because there was a man-eating mountain lion out at the time. So most of the mountain lions were high up in the Himalayas, but this one had come down a bit lower. I mean, I was pretty high, I suppose. Well, what would I have been, about 2,000 metres. And so he'd come down and he'd get a taste of human flesh. So he had to be inside. Mm-hmm. But during those walks in the daytime, I was, like you with the meditation, I was able to access realms of my mind that I had never done since I was a 6-year-old in my herb garden and haven't been able to since. I was just going out to places, but I have a sort of strong mind. I know I'm not going to get lost in them, you know. I think a lot of people with my sort of my mind tendency towards mind would end up in mental institutions because you go a bit too far. I seem to be able to go to those rounds and then pull myself back. So I was going very far out into places. And but the only time I said the word...
Do you mean places internally?
Yeah.
Within yourself?
Yeah, exactly. Really just gorgeous place where everything, like you with the nettle, everything seemed utterly united. And there was this sense of euphoria, this absolute love and white wash of white light and euphoria.
Were you meditating while doing these walks? Were you conscious of your breathing, things like that?
No, no. In fact, I've only started meditating during COVID.
Wow.
Yeah.
You mad cunt. I know,
but just because I had that access, I suppose. But my only problem was once, I was doing as well. I was following Ayurvedic medicine. Well, I was only one strand of it at the time, which meant drinking my own urine, copious amounts of my own urine.
Fair play to you.
Not anyone else's, luckily, but my own. So when I went down to the Almora, to the leper station every 10 days to check on the lepers, I'd also write a fax home to my mother. I was a sort of a dutiful son. And my dad had just died.
How are you getting on, man? Drinking my own piss. I'm scared of a mountain lion.
That was it. Exactly. But that wasn't where. But no, I wanted to reassure her. So I didn't say that. Instead, I said, Mum.
Has Granny got any more IRA prisoners in the house?
No, I wanted to reassure her. So I said, Mum, in Irish, actually. But I said, you know, everything is brilliant, Mum. Don't worry about me. Everything is one. I see that we are all unified. Every leaf and every raindrop is one. And there's light connecting all of the universe and all. We are blissfully happy. And there is gorgeousness. And there is only, you know, unified connection. So she believed that her sort of overeducated youngest son had gone around the twist, had gone mentally insane. And, you know, some people would say I had. I'm convinced I hadn't. But she sent my brother on this mission of mercy to rescue me. Now, my brother was a very serious, pragmatic man. He was in the film industry. Yeah. And he was working in this is 95, 96, the years that Far and Away were made. He was locations manager on that and on Devil's Own with Brad Pitt and on all those big movies. So my mum says, go over to India and rescue Mankan. He's lost the plot. So my brother was busy with all his things. He didn't want to do that. But at the same time, he really could see himself, you know, he was just locations manager in the big Hollywood movies. He wanted to direct and he thought that he could direct a TV series. And 1996 was the year that TG Carr, Fianna Fáil announced they were going to set up TG Carr, a brand new Irish language television station. So my brother hatches the plan that he's going to direct the first ever travel program in Irish, and I'm going to present it. So he comes out.
Fucking hell.
And he's very serious and pragmatic. So he comes out in a full safari suit, as though he was a director of, you know, Born Free or something, with a load of heavy duty equipment. Actually, it was the very first edition of a Sony digital camera. Whatever, those little digi tapes. And it was not HD, it was over digi. And one ship digital camera. And he convinced Sony that he was going to make the first ever TV program with it. He comes out to Delhi, then goes up to Almora, then finds his way to Papazali and asks in the local chai shop, where is Mankan living in the cowshed? And he finds me, and like, I'm not in a good way. Like, I am, I've been drinking my piss for a long time now. I am far out in sort of glorious parts of my brain. And he's just disgusted. I'm wearing like dirty old T-shirts and sweaty, smelly sweatpants. And he's just like, and my hair is a mess. And he says, Mankan, we're making a TV program. I have not wasted my time. I haven't come the whole way out here and got this gig from TG Carr so that you can screw it up. So he drags me down to Almora. He washes me. He gets my hair cut. He buys me a new shirt and trousers and puts me in front of the camera, his little new digital Sony. And of course, I'm only too happy to be put in the camera because I have loads to tell people how we are all unified and how drinking piss will cleanse your insides and how everything is one and everything is gorgeous. And Ruan watches this, my brother watches this, and he turns off the camera. And it's just, I can see the sadness, the break and brokenheartedness. He's put so much work into this. He's convinced TG Carr, who have no idea who he is or who I am, that this is worth taking a punt on, and I'm about to screw it up. And he screams at me, he roars at me, and he says, for fuck's sake, Mankan, I have not come this way. You better get your act together. So he turns on the camera again, and I just spout my beautiful new age rubbish again. And so it goes on for weeks. He slowly, over those weeks, tells me what to say. He threatens me to what to say. And I just have to say, we're in India now, and it's lovely, and we're starting our journey. And if you see that program, I might put a clip of it up on the internet. You see this kid who is just, God love him, he's just lost. He could easily be an institution. His eyes have that faraway look. He's just like so many, you know, young backpackers you see. But luckily, Ruan, my brother, taught me to be pragmatic, that you cannot go that far out, that you need to find a way of communicating ideas. And ever since that, that was 96. Every year since then, we made a television documentary for TG Car in China, in Africa, in South America, in Greenland, just all over the world. Until eventually then Hector came along, and Hector says, like, let's make a program where you don't have this, like, idiot pontificating to camera the whole time. And he made a program that actually was sort of funny and comedic. One little question there, right?
Because you started off by talking about when you were a kid and hearing voices and stuff, right? And I had on this podcast a psychiatrist called Dr. Pat Bracken, who is a psychiatrist, but he's also very anti-psychiatry. And he is very interested in, we'll say, hearing voices, but looking at it from different cultures. He says that hearing voices in our Western medicalized culture is immediately seen as a bad thing. But there's other cultures around the world where hearing voices is not stigmatized. And in these cultures where hearing voices isn't stigmatized, the people, the voices that people hear are actually quite nice. But in societies like ours, where it's medicalized and said that it's a bad thing or labeled as schizophrenia, the voices tend to be terrifying.
Wow.
How do you feel about that? I mean, because you seem to, even to the point he talks about, there's now a movement where people don't like to be referred to as psychotic, they don't like to be referred to as having schizophrenia. They're simply part of a community that hear voices, and this is how they live, and this is their life. How do you feel about that? Is it ringing true with you?
Yeah, so because I sometimes talk about, you know, these experiences to people, and they often think, okay, were you schizophrenic or were you? I really don't think I had anything like that, because I had just all, they were just such loving voices. But what you're saying, is the fact that so many people have so much tension in them now, and so much, you know, their voices are so full of paranoia and darkness. Is it just a reflection on a society that doesn't make sense? Like, if you're living in a society that really looks like it's going to commit suicide, then I suppose it's natural that some people would have those darkest thoughts. So let's say back to what the psychiatrist said. We know, yes, definitely other cultures accepted that that there were, you could hear, you had access to other voices, but it just happens that so too did our culture, so too did the Irish language. You know, every single traditional story, folk story, it's about an encounter with the other world, and that other world, like, okay, this is something now. So the she, you know, the she yoga, the she, the fairies, she means, she used to mean a fairy mound, okay? You know, she, Gwyhe, a gust of wind that is actually the fairies. But she was a fairy mound, and then it became the fairies where they lived, and then it was the fairies themselves, the she or the sheoga. Now, the she is the same word as the root for Siachán, for peace. In fact, in Scots Gaelic, S-I-T-H is she, fairy, and S-I-T-H is peace, the same word, okay? Now, the old way of spelling she, fairy, was Sidhe, S-I-D-H-E. Now, Sidhe, that Irish word, the old word for fairy, is the same word as Sidhe in Sanskrit, in Hinduism, in Buddhism, and in Zoroastrianism. Basically, Sidhe is an enlightened being. Okay, so you suddenly realize these fairies actually are enlightened beings. It's the same word. There's no linguistic, you know, uncertainty about this. A she is the same word as Sidhe, an enlightened being who, you know, a being who would have stepped out of, this is a human being who would have taken a step back from the small-mindedness of reality and realized that there was a bigger dream and a bigger vision and connected themselves to something grander. So let's say these fairies, and where do the fairies live? They live underground beside humans, but they live nearby and they are obsessed with us. They're constantly looking at what humans are doing and laughing at us and telling us, what do they tell us to do? They tell us to celebrate more, to feast more, to play, to dance, to party. So, and whenever we tell them, whenever we go to them with our small scale concerns, as all of the stories do, you know, you go when you're in time of worry or time of heartache, and they laugh at you and they laugh at your obsession with time. So what do we know about the Sidhe, these enlightened beings, the fairies? They They do not accept time, which now we realize is not true. They want us to have a bigger vision and not to be so locked up in our small-mindedness. So actually, our culture, from the very beginnings, from every single folk story you were told in school, is only trying to tell you one thing. You can root yourself to nature and you can root yourself to a world that is beyond the physical, to a world that is nourishing, where there is advice and guidance there. Even like a word like... Pukog, or Pukog is a blindfold. Okay, it also can mean a goat muzzle, and it can mean a tin shield for putting over a thieving cow's eyes. But also, but the main meaning, sort of, for Pukog is I don't have that quite right. Pukog, it is almost Pukog. I'll tell you it in a second. It's an otherworldly being that can that can appear invisible in this world. An otherworldly being that can pukeen is the word. You still use it in English, you know, put a pukeen, a blindfold over someone. So it's an otherworldly being that can appear invisible in this world. So we knew, our ancestors, even our grannies knew, that there were people who could jump from Crihir or from Counter, which is this region or this place, to Altar, the other world, and that there was amazing reassurance to be got from that. And I would just, all of our problems could be solved if we expanded our awareness to realize that bigger picture. We would no longer have the anxiety, and we might have answers to a deeper connection to nature, to, as you said, that belief that we are one with the nettle. It is there to heal us, and we are there, you know, to be part of it.
Do you, one thing I found really interesting there is when you were speaking about people speaking about interactions with the fairies and the fairies laughing at them, like literally that, when I go onto the internet and I listen to people recount their ayahuasca or DMT trips, a lot of people report visiting somewhere where time doesn't exist, reality doesn't exist, and they meet these beings that they can't describe. They're crystal beings, and they basically laugh at them and they have fun with them. Like, do you, the similarities between modern day ayahuasca DMT trips and what you've just described with ancient Irish fairies, do you see a correlation there?
Absolutely, yeah. And to get back to a point about that salmon that we didn't make, what do we know about a salmon? Yeah. A salmon is speckled. What else is speckled? The fly agaric mushroom, the Amanita muscaria mushroom.
I was thinking speckled dove ecstasy, but humans make them.
No, the fly agaric mushroom. And again, what do we know about that? I have a chapter in my book about the riastra. The riastra was Cú Chulainn's warp spasm. When he would get totally furious or angry, he would just have fire and flames shooting out of his top of his head. His eyeballs, his pupils would dilate to the extent that they were popping out so much that it said like a heron could bite it or a crane could bite it off. It's a perfect example of that mescaline-induced, transcendental state, which you don't get from magic mushrooms, you get from fly agaric.
Also, those Vikings, what were those Vikings called who used to take mushrooms?
The berserker. Barbarians? Yeah, the berserkers. Exactly.
They used to take fly agaric mushrooms, and it would make them incredibly angry as they went into battle, and they went berserk.
Exactly. And the Sami people still do. But you know the way there's some, the fly agaric mushroom needs to be taken with great care.
Because it's poisonous, isn't it?
Sometimes. I have a podcast at the moment, actually, and in one of it I talked to Courtney Taylor, a great expert in Wicklow, a mushroom collector, who really actually demystifies the poisonous element of the fly agaric mushroom. And I also, in that, it's called the Almanac of Ireland, but also I talked to Billy McLean, who tells me about that Glasgaven, those magical stones outside his land. Also in that one, I post myself into a cave, which is the Cave of Transformation, Aon na Gach in Roscommon. And I go down there for 7 hours. Well, no, I don't do 7 hours in the end. I do about 3 hours to see what transformative. So the Aon na Gach was the Cave of Transformation in the Tairne Mhuir Cuilinne and all the old myths, where someone would go down and they would enter the other world. Why did I get onto that? Oh, yeah, Berserker. So the fly agaric, not only that, but the Sami culture of northern Lapland still take the fly agaric. And the reason, so it can be slightly poisonous. It's not as poisonous as we think, but it relaxes the muscles. And so if it goes out, if it touches the heart, it'll relax the heart. And, you know, the heart might, you don't want your heart to relax, you know, because that means it stops. So what the Vikings used to do and what the Sami people still do is they let the deer or the reindeer eat it first, and then they drink the urine of the reindeer, and then the mescaline element will have passed through in its pure state without the poison. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
But that speckle, the fly agaric, it's a classic mushroom you've seen. It's in every fairy story, you know, it's a red mushroom with the white dots. And whenever you come across speckled in any of the old folk stories, and you will come across it everywhere, that's what it's a that's potentially what it's a reference to. It's a hint that to access this other world that we're talking about, the fairies or with Finn McCool or the magic mushrooms or the hazelnut of insight, they are you can get to those through the fly agaric.
Wow. So one last question, because I'm time conscious now. I know you need to fuck off.
Very good.
I need to ask you about your sustainable living. I need to ask you about the house that you live in. And you live in a passive house, is that correct?
No, not really. So I didn't want a mortgage. So when I came back from Africa, South America and India, I had seen people there build their houses out of what was around them. So in Bolivia, they use reeds. In Tibet, they use stone. In Africa, they use mud. In India, they use straw, whatever. So I came back. I had my granny, the Republican revolutionist, Sheila Humphreys. She died and left me 10 grand. So in 1997, I came back to Ireland and had my 10 grand and looked for anywhere I could buy and find 10 acres. And luckily, Westmead welcomed me in. And I looked around and saw, what am I going to build my house out of? And there they were growing barley straw. So I bought myself 200 straw bales of good barley straw, and just used those as Lego blocks, like as big Weetabix, to build my house and put a metal roof on it. And I didn't have planning permission. And I lived in for 6 years. I told the planners that this is what I'm building, and then I'll apply for planning for the next house. So they gave me, in their wisdom, Westmeath County Council, in their just kindness, they gave me permission for the straw bale house. So that first house cost me 5 or 6 grand. I lived in it for 6 years. And then I built the second house for 26 grand. It was meant to be bales of straw, but in the end I got scared and I put concrete block in this core of it. And I put grass on the roof just because I didn't know how to tile, but I knew how to just wheelbarrow a load of mud up onto the roof. And then I put mud and straw on the outside of the concrete because it looked very angular. And I built that in 2002 for 26 grand. And I've been living there ever since. And just in recent years, I wanted to create my independence, just because I don't have a great income in any way. You know, I do a little bit for the Irish Times. I write books, but those, God love it, those travel books I wrote about all those trips, you know, they don't sell much. So I started growing my own vegetables. Oh, no, first thing I did, I planted 6 acres of the 10 acres in oak wood. I did that 20 years ago, and God, it was slow. But now massive oaks. I have these big, big oaks, 20-year-old oaks. And then I got pigs. I got Tamworth, the old native pig, in. And put the pigs in, and then I now have hens and I have turkeys and I have whatever, about 5 beehives, and I have.
So are you living off the land as such? Are you living in a way where you don't need money for a lot of your needs?
Exactly, yeah. So I put 4.3 kilowatts of solar panels in, so I'd have electricity most of the time. First thing I did, you know, 23 years ago when I moved here, was put up the polytunnel. Clearly things like, you know, lentils and flour I'm still buying in. I'd like to grow enough, you know, grain just for my own bread. But during COVID again, I am growing so much more since COVID, because all of those things, they take up an enormous amount of time. So none of them I would have been doing to the extent, the scale I wanted to, until this year.
Are you preserving vegetables and shit like that? Are you canning things and stuff?
I am, exactly. I'm doing that. And again, something I'd never done until this year was save my seed, because it was so easy. Save, you know, herbal seed, flower seeds, because it was so easy to just, you know, go online and order packages.
Yeah.
But during COVID, they were sold out, you know, and the great brown envelope seeds in Cork and Seed Savers in Clare, they were all saying, we have none left. Save your own seed. Like, the shops were actually telling you, don't come to us. Do it yourself. So that was a big learning experience for me this year. The power of being utterly independent means controlling your seeds as well as your irrigation, your electricity, your food source. Yeah.
So I leave you going now, Mancon, right? Thank you so much for that. That was an absolutely fantastic chat. It was so interesting. I'd love to have you on again, man. I'd say me and you could talk about fucking anything for a long time.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And I'm just so bowled over by the work you do.
Oh, thank you so much, man. Thank you.
See you now.
All right. See you, man. Have a good one. Bye bye. Oh, that was absolutely lovely. What a wonderful conversation that I had there with Mancon. That felt fantastic for me because I'm fucking locked up with coronavirus, so I'm not seeing a lot of people. I really enjoyed that. I'm going to be back next week with, I've got a couple of hot takes on the pot, lads. And I'm trying to decide which one I'm going to give you. But I'm going to have a hot take next week. And I'm looking forward to recording next week's podcast. Mind yourself.
have some self-compassion, have some compassion for other people. And like I said at the start of the podcast, don't be stressing yourself out over things that are outside of your control. Focus on what is inside of your control, all right? And you'll be grand. Yart.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.